We are Dalet Amud Aleph. Page is 4A3 in the English. Now, since we took a break last week, it may be just possibly that you don't remember all the details of where we left off. So I thought I would give you a little bit of a review just so that we again have in our mind what the subject is that we're discussing. And tonight I'm going to try really hard to get to the end of this subject. So if I move us along a little bit, just forgive me, because there's just so much of one subject that I think I could take. So we're on this subject of Eim LaMasoret, Eim LaMikra, which I think is undoubtedly a very interesting subject. We discussed it rather thoroughly last week. But I think also we've got to get back to the halacha. So, just to recall what we're discussing, the Mishnah says, Dinei Mamonot Bishlosha. The law, monetary cases are decided in a court of three. And that seems simple enough. We knew what that meant. It's just very straightforward that you have three people to decide something that would be categorized as a monetary case. So we saw that, and we actually saw a proof of it, that there were three places in the Torah, in Shemot, where, and this was a case of somebody who was a custodian, an unpaid custodian, and this person was given something to guard, and lo and behold, the thing disappears. And so the person who owned the object was suspicious of this custodian that he stole it. Okay? So the custodian says, no way, I didn't steal it. So how do you prove it? There's no way to prove this. So in fact, the Torah says that the custodian, that both of them have to go to Ha-Elohim, and that was the discussion. We saw Ha-Elohim was mentioned three times, and since it is mentioned three times, and this is a case which is a case of money, we learn from that since Ha-Elohim can refer to a judge, that we have three judges. Okay. So that seemed fine. You know, it may not have been something that was completely logical to us, that we would necessarily take a repetition of a word and learn from that three judges. But, you know, all right, the Gemara has its own way of doing things, so it seemed fine. Then we get a little bit further, and we see Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says, no, a monetary case, the court, has five judges. So that was out of left field. How could Rabbi Yehuda Nasi say that a court that deals with monetary cases has five judges? Just didn't seem logical. So the Gemara says, no, it's perfectly logical. When the Mishnah says that a court for monetary cases is a court of three, what it means is that the verdict is determined by a majority that has three. So when we thought we understood the Mishnah to begin with, that it was just three people were the size of the court, no, the number of people that's got to make the decision all on one side has got to be three. So that would mean that the minimal size court you could have is five. So that's why Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says five. So that's what the Gemara tries to understand his reasoning that way. Then the Gemara goes on and there's an objection to that. And the objection is, if you say that, then all the other numbers that were given in the Mishnah you have to interpret the same way. And therefore, if there's a court of 72, that means that the court of 72 is not 72, but 144. And we never knew that there was a court of 144. Nobody ever heard of such a thing. So that couldn't be the right explanation. Okay? So, we had to move on. Has a hypothetical tried to solve the problem, to figure out why Rabbi Yehuda Nasi took the point of view he did, then the Gemara decides finally that that's not true. It can't be that. So then it tries something else. And the next thing that it tries is that it shows us that there are really different ways to understand this passage, this same passage from Shemot, where we had Ha-Elohim, Ha-Elohim, Ha-Elohim. Well, if you look at it more carefully, you see that there is a phrase in the latter piece of the passage. Oh, let's see, it's 23:19. Which was Yarshi'un, Exodus 23:19. Yeah. Doesn't look like that. No, that's different. Parashat Mishpatim. Here we go. Okay. This is Exodus 23:8. Exodus 23:8. Al kol dvar kesha al shor al chamor al se al salma al kol aveda asher yomar ki hu zeh ad Elohim yavo devar shneihem asher yashi'un Elohim yishalem shneihem shnayim l'rehehu. So there we had Elohim appearing twice, okay? And the key thing that the Gemara now raises for us is we had assumed that Elohim was one judge. Elohim was one judge, okay? But that's not necessarily true because it says here, Elohim asher yavo devar, ad ha-Elohim yavo devar shneihem. To the Elohim shall come the matter of both of them. Asher Yarshi'un, the ones that the Elohim will declare the guilty ones.
But
that's now plural. So if we have this word Elohim twice in the same verse, and the verb is a plural verb, the minimum that that's referring to is Elohim, that means two. So, now we have something else. Now we have two. And we have two. And we have the first time it was mentioned is one. So that's five. Or there was another way we could think of it too. It could have been two and two and maybe two. Every one of them should be considered as two. And we'd have six. But remember, the first time you mentioned something, that's one. That doesn't count, right? Because to establish the concept, we need at least one. So anyway, we end up with five. So what the Gemara says is that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, when he reads the Torah, reads it, Yesh Em LaMikra. That is to say, even though Yarshi'un is written without a kubutz at the end, because you don't have any dots in a Torah, and you don't have, there is no Vav there, it's pronounced as if the Vav were there. So it's Yarshi'un, but if you look at it, it seems to say Yarshi'an, which would be singular. It would be singular. So Rabbi Yehuda Nasi takes the point of view, say, Yesh Em LaMikra. When you have a choice between how you read something and how it looks based on how it is written, primacy is given to the oral tradition, to the way that we have learned to read it, the way we hear it. Okay? It's heard as Yarshi'un, even though it's written as Yarshi'an. Yesh Em LaMikra. Primacy is given to the way it sounds and not to the way it's written. Okay. Then we went into the discussion of other cases where other rabbis took this point of view as well. They had a variety of different ones, and I won't go over them in detail because we're going to sort of go over them again shortly. Actually, we skipped one, and I'm going to leave that skipped, partly because I don't want to really start there. I'd like to start fresh Okay, we'll get into that, otherwise it gets too complicated. That's where we are now on 4A3. Okay? So we know a few Tanaim, a few other rabbis, among them obviously Rabbi Judah the Prince, who hold by the principle Yesh Eim Lamikra. There is primacy to the way something is read. Matkif la Rav Acha bar Yaakov. Rav Acha bar Yaakov objects. He rejects. Objects to what we've just said. Okay? Mi ike de leit le yesh em la mikra. He says, is there anybody who doesn't give primacy to the way something is read? We're presuming that there are two groups of people here. There are those who say, Yeshem LaMikra, give primacy to the way it's read. There are those who say, Yeshem LaMasoret, give primacy to the way it's written. So here comes Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov, and he says, no, that's not true. There aren't two groups of people. Everybody agrees, Yeshem LaMikra, that you have to give primacy to the way something is read. And we had said that last time. Some of you had said that really, it's obvious to you that the way something is read, the oral tradition, really has got to be the more important one. It's got to be the more important one. It's got to take precedence before, either for historical reasons, that Moses heard something first before it was written down, or it just stands to reason that in a language, the way you hear it really must take precedence over the way it's written. Because writing always reduces something to a more, how can we say it, a more questionable certainty. Okay? Maybe. That's what some of you had said. So here, Acha bar Yaakov says, well, nobody takes the point of view, Yesh Eim LaMasoret. Well, we just saw several people who seem to take that point of view. So first he's going to tell us why nobody takes that point of view. And then, if he is successful in telling us that, in showing us a case where that must be true, he's going to have to explain each of the cases we've already learned about where Yesh Eim LaMasoret seem to make perfect sense. Right? He's going to have to explain it in a different way. So here it says, Matkif la Rav Acha bar Yaakov, mi ik delet le yesh em la mikra. Can there be anyone who doesn't take the point of view that there is primacy to the way it sounds? Vahatanya. Take a look at this Maraita that I'm going to show you now. Bachalev imo. All right. The Torah says, this is verse 29. Okay, chapter 2, verse 29. Here we go. Okay. Ki ta'aseh l'shorcha l'tzonecha shivat yamim yeim imo bayom hashmini. No, that's wrong. That's the wrong. 23:19 it is. 19. Okay. No? It's 22.
It's on the inner
margin.
I
want to
read from
Shabbos. Oh, I don't read from Shabbos. That's good. I don't read that's good. Okay. Okay. 19. Reshit bikurei ad matcha tavi beit Hashem Elokecha. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring to the Lord your God. Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Okay? You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. B'chalev imo. So listen to this. Chalev imo, we understand, means in its mother's milk. You know the laws of kashrut. In fact, that's mentioned three times in the Torah, and therefore we learn that you can't take benefit from it, you can't boil it, and you can't eat something where the meat has been put together and cooked with the milk. Okay. So, Bachalev. It says Bachalev Imo. You can see the way it's written there in the Hebrew. Yachol Bachalev. Why can't you read that Bachalev? Now, Chalev means fat. Fat. The same letters could be read Bachalev. You shall not cook a kid in its mother's fat. How do you come off telling me that this is a law about milk and meat? We know that you're not allowed to eat fat from the animal, the chalev of the animal, to begin with. And how much more so you're not allowed to do it with a kid. Okay? So it says chet lamed bet. How do you know to read it chalev or chalev? How do you know? Well, there must only be one way to know. And that is, you know, because yesh eim lamikra. There is primacy to the way something is read. Right? So nobody would ever take the point of view here, saying here, that this means that you can't cook a kid in its mother's fat. Nobody has that point of view. So obviously everybody has the point of view that primacy is given to the way something sounds. Okay? Let's go on. Amarta yesh em lamikra. Therefore, you have to say that yesh em lamikra, everybody agrees that there's primacy to the way something is pronounced. Well, if that's true now, we have to figure out all the other things. All right, Ella b'kuli alma yesh em lamikra. He goes further and he says, not only is it true in this case, but everybody agrees in every case that yesh em lamikra, that there is primacy given to the way something is read. The Rabbi v'Rabbanan b'hai kamiflagei, and Rebbe and the rabbis argue about something else. They argue about something else. It couldn't be that they're arguing about Eshem LaMikra ve'Eim LaMasoret, because Rebbe and the rabbis would both agree Eshem LaMikra. Everybody agrees Eshem LaMikra. Okay? Rabbi Savar Yarshi Un Elohim Acharine. Rebbe holds that when the verse says whoever the judges condemn, it refers to two other judges. The Rabbanan Savre Yarshi Un Dahai Vahach, and the rabbis hold that they condemn refers to the judge mentioned earlier, this judge and that judge. Let's see what this says. Okay, Rebbe says, Yarshi'un has to be understood in the plural. Okay? So that we know, he said it had to be understood, so that we already had. He understood two and two was four. You can follow that? Two and two is four. You can't have a court of four. You have to have a court of five. Okay, so we can understand Rebbe that way. That's one way to understand Rebbe. But the difficult one is, how about the rabbis? We understood that they saw Yarshi'an as singular, and so that's how they got to the number three. That's how they began. So if they're taking it as plural, they should understand it the way Rebbe does, as four. And you'd have to then go up to five. So how do they understand it? Rabbanan Savre Yarshi'un Dahai Vahach. That phrase, Yarshi'un, is plural. They read it as plural. But it's a plural because we had one judge here in the beginning of the sentence, one judge there in the end of the sentence. And how many are one and one? Two. Okay? So two is already a plural. You can't have a court of two. You have to have a court of three. Okay? So here, even with the grammar, if the grammar is plural, you can just, if something is repeated, you can understand it as one judge here, one judge there, and therefore you have a plural verb, simply not referring to the same judges. Okay? So that's reasonable. Okay, so now we understand the first case. how you could even say that everybody agrees that there is primacy la mikra to the way something is read, even in the argument between Rebbe and the rabbis. Okay? That there's a court of five or there's a court of three. Now let's go to the next one. Okay, the next one was Rabbi Yehuda ben Ro'etz lo poligi rabbanan alei. That, you remember that case? That was the one about where we learned that if a woman gives birth and she has a male baby, then she is forbidden to her husband for a week. And if she has a female baby, she is forbidden to her husband for shivuayim. Shivuayim. But it was 2 weeks. 2 weeks. But it's not written shivuayim. It's written Shin Bet Ayin Yud Mem. Shin Bet Ayin Yud Mem. Which could be read Shiv'im. Shiv'im. Okay? If you're going to read it the way it is, it could be Shiv'im.
She wanted Shiv'im. You pushed her to
Okay. So that we saw, there was a... here we had two cases. It could be Eim La Mikra Eim La Masoret. But what the Gemara says now, lo pligi rabbanan alei, as far as the point of view of Rabbi Yehuda ben Ro'etz, who says it's shivuayim, no other rabbi took the opposite point of view. Nobody ever said that it's shivim. Right? Shivim is just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. 70. 70. To suddenly have one that's a week and the other one that's 70, even in the argument that we read before, if you remember, it was said that that would be a ridiculous argument. And essentially, the Gemara says, it is a ridiculous. Nobody would ever really say that. That's not logical. Okay? And in fact, nobody does. Nobody does. So there's no disagreement. In fact, even though you might have said there could be a disagreement, nobody ever does disagree. Nobody has that point of view. Okay? So we now deal with, we've dealt with two of the problems. The third one, you remember, was the case of the minimal number of times that you have to sprinkle on the altar. You have to sprinkle blood on the altar. Right? And remember, achat, achat, the achat, you sprinkle some blood, and achat, you do it one time, and in fact it falls on the two corners, because the blood is sprinkled on the corners of the altar. The altar is square. Okay, in shape, and you're sprinkling on the corners. Now, most of the sacrifices are sprinkled down below. There is a line that goes around the altar, and you have to sprinkle below that line. With the exception, however, of a chatat, the sin offering. The sin offering is sprinkled on the horns of the altar, which is above that line. It's above that line. Okay? So we had the case Beit Hillel, Diktanya v'chiper v'chiper v'chiper. The question was, if you are required, if the Torah says that you have to sprinkle four times, what if you sprinkle fewer times? Remember, the sprinkling is the key activity in the korban, in bringing a korban. When you bring an offering, it's not the slaughtering that you get credit for, but it's ultimately the sprinkling. And until you sprinkle the blood, it's as if nothing has happened. Okay? So you're required, the Kohen is required to come and sprinkle four times. Four times. What if he only sprinkles three times? What if he only sprinkles two times? What if he only sprinkles one time? What if he never sprinkles at all? Okay? Okay. So, in fact, there is, seems to be here, the Gemara is assuming that you don't have to do everything that you're told to do. You should do it, but if you do less, you can still get credit for it. Okay? And I gave you the example even in the tzitzit. Remember, if you don't have the tzechelet in the tzitzit, is it okay? It is. In fact, it's perfectly kosher tzitzit. Okay? Even though the Torah says that you have to have the blue thread of the tzitzit. Tradition is that even though you should, if you don't, it's perfectly kosher. So we have the same thing here with the sprinklings. Now, in the laws of sprinkling, I have to remember, again, I repeat something that we learned before, that is that the way you learn if something is obligatory, that is to say, without it, you don't qualify at all, is if you have some scriptural basis of repetition. Something has to be repeated. If you just say it three times, then it means that you don't even have to do it at all. In the laws of sacrifice, it's only in the law of sacrifice. The law of sacrifice, the difference between what you're supposed to do and what it's okay even if you don't do it, is if something is repeated. Okay? So if you have three times, and then the fourth time it's repeated, three times is for some reason the way it's supposed to be, and then there's one time that it's superfluous, a fourth time, then what we learn from that is that one time is absolutely necessary. Right? If two times are said, and we get all the information that we need about the sacrifice in the two times, and then we have two additional times where something is said, and it's superfluous for two times, how many times do we have to have it done? Two. We'd have to have it done two. Because it's the repetition that, in effect, is the bottom line of what you absolutely have to do. Okay? So here, Beit Hillel said to Tanya, Beit Hillel, who believes that all you need to do is sprinkle once. All you need to do is sprinkle once. The Tanya v'chiper, v'chiper, v'chiper. Right? The verb, you shall atone, you shall atone, you shall atone, which is the sprinkling, is repeated three times. And that's for the chatat offering, for the sin offering. Okay? Mipnei adim. You might have understood this, the fact that it's repeated three times, logically. You might have derived some, by virtue of logic, in this effort for us to figure out what the bottom line is, how many times it has to be done, you might have done this on the basis of logic. And here, we're going to go into a little bit of a logical argument. Mipnei adim. And what is it? V'halo dinhu. You could say the following. This is how you should figure out what the bottom line is. Ne'amar damim lamata. When we learn about those blood applications that have to be brought lamata, underneath the line, that is to say, for all of the sacrifices except the chatat, which is done above the line on the altar, ne'amar damim lamata, ne'amar damim lamala. We learn something about blood that's to be applied below the line for most of the sacrifices, and blood that's to be applied above the line above for the chatat. Ma damim ha'amurim lamata. As we know that the blood that is given below the line, shenetanan b'matana achat kiter, we learn that just one sprinkling is enough, and we'll see what that is. I think we'll see what it is. After mima amurim lemala, shenetan b'matana achat kiter. Also, it is true for the chatat, which is sprinkled above, that just one is enough. O klach l'derech sel. Or you might have logically reasoned in a slightly different way. And he said the following. Ne'amar damim b'chutz. You could have said that the blood that is offered on the outside. Now there are two altars. There's an outer altar and an inner altar. The inner altar is the gold altar. There are certain chatot, a limited number of sin offerings where the blood is sprinkled on the inner altar. Okay? So, ne'amar damim b'chutz, we learn blood that's sprinkled on the outer altar, the one we've been talking about, the ne'amar damim b'bifnim, also blood is sprinkled on the inner altar. And the one that we're interested in ultimately is the chatat, the sin offering. The sprinkling on the inner altar is only a sin offering. So if we can learn something about the inner, we might be able to apply it to the outer. Because the outer, we're trying to establish the sin offering above the line. Okay? if we can get some solid information about the inner altar, we might be able to apply it to the altar. That's what's going to happen now. As in the blood application that is stated as far as the inner altar goes, if the Kohen omits even one application, he has accomplished nothing. That is to say, you have to do everything. You can't omit anything as far as the inner altar goes. You might say that as far as the outer one goes, if you miss even one of the sprinklings, it's as if you've done nothing. Now, I don't want to go into this too much detail. It's not really too crucial, except for the following. What's going on here? The Mara is saying, if we're going to make decisions based on logic, right? There are really two ways that we can make the logic. Logic implies analogy. And if we're trying to find out the answer to a question based on analogy, the truth is we have two different possibilities of analogy. On the one hand, we have an analogy from the bottom of the altar to the top of the altar, but they're two different kinds of sacrifice. Two different types. One is a shlamim, a goodwill or free will offering. The other is a chatat. Okay, maybe you can make logically go from the bottom of the altar to the top of the altar because they're both in the same altar. Or maybe logically the only way to do it is chatat to chatat. Chatat that's offered on the inner altar and chatat that's offered on the outer altar. Okay? If you go the first way, you end up with one required sprinkle. If you go the second way, you're going to end up with four required sprinkles. Okay? Now what the Gemara is simply doing is saying, if we use logic to figure this out, how do we know which is more logical? How do we know which is a better analogy? One analogy brings us to one. The other analogy brings us to four. Those are pretty different conclusions to draw from analogy. That's the Gemara's way of saying, you can't do this from analogy. All right? Even though we might have been tempted to use logic is really insufficient because we don't know how to create the correct analogy. We have two analogies, and in fact, both analogies are reasonably good. Okay. Let's see, where did I end off here? Let's go down. Nireh lemi domeh danin chutz michutz. Should we create the analogy of one thing on the outside to the other thing on the outside? That is to say, sprinkling in the bottom of the altar to the sprinkling in the top of the altar, and create that analogy. And that's to say, we wouldn't learn the inside altar to the outside altar, just the outside altar. Or should we create the other analogy? Danin chatat. V'dalet kranot mechatat v'arba kranot. We learn the four from the four. One is the inner altar, is a chatat. The other is an outer altar, that's a chatat. That's our choice. V'al yochiach ze she'in chatat v'dalet kranot. And we can't learn from the two outer altar things because they're not both the same kind of offering. Okay? Talmud Lomar. Therefore, the Torah teaches us to save us from that horrendous possibility of having to make an incorrect analogy. It rather gives us text to interpret. Talmud Lomar v'chiper v'chiper v'chiper. Therefore, we have a repetition of the word v'chiper three times. Mipnei Abin. In order for us to go and learn from that as opposed to logic, because the logic was a conundrum. Kiper af al pi shelo natan ela shlosha The first time the expression appears, it teaches that the Kohen effects atonement, even though he made only three applications. Kiper afal pishalonatan elishtayim. The second time the expression appears, it teaches that the Kohen effects atonement, even though he only made two applications. Kiper afal pishalonatan elachat. The third time the expression appears, it teaches that the Kohen effects atonement, even though he made only one application. Okay, look at the note 14. The Gemaran's Vachin demonstrates that each of these three verses is apparently superfluous. Therefore, each teaches another possibility of atonement for a chatat whose prescribed procedure of applying blood to the four horns was not fulfilled. If each of these is superfluous, it depends on how many of them are superfluous. Remember, the superfluous one will tell us what the bottom line is. If we have three mentions of chiper that are superfluous, then three are required. If we have two that are superfluous, then two are required. If we have one that is superfluous, then one is required. Okay? So basically, that's how Hillel reasons. In fact, one is superfluous. Right? One is there to teach us the basic law. One is to teach some other aspect of the law. One eventually becomes superfluous, and therefore it is only the one that is required. Okay? For what it's worth. The key thing is, though, that Beit Hillel learned this, learned the one, not from a difference in how something was read or how it was written. He used the chiper, the chiper, the chiper to learn it. Okay? So in other words, he can still have the point of view, yesh em la mikra. Yesh em la mikra. Okay, enough said about that. I hope you don't have any questions about it. If you have a question about it, how are you getting it? Yes?
In the lifetime of Hillel, the Hamikdash was still functioning.
Correct. You're right. And the other one is Shammai, of course, who lived also in the same time, so he could have asked as well. So how could it be that you have two answers and not one answer?
Right.
Well, the answer can readily be that it doesn't say Hillel and Shammai, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Okay? Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai extend after that. Right, so that already is apparently after the destruction. There's nobody to ask. Or whoever you ask, because you're dealing with the students now and not the original. Okay?
I have a question that belongs to our last session.
Our last session?
Yeah. And that's in regards...
Think I remember anything from last time?
Yeah. Emla Masoret, Emla Mikra, and the line from God to Moses, and then Moses read to the people.
Yeah.
But we know that Moses was Kvat Pepe, Kvat Lashon.
Right.
And Aaron was... Right. So, in the whole discussion of transmitting it to the people, Aaron was the one who is doing the job, the way I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, we don't even have one mentioning of...
That's true. Because
where is the correlation between the truth, what was written, if let's say Moses talked about it, mm-hmm. how we know that he was right, or what the people were saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, the assumption here... it's the assumption that they're working with, that Moses dictated to Aaron.
Yeah, and that,
problem or no problem, he was able to dictate correctly to Aaron. Okay, that's the assumption. More than that, I can't say. That's what they're assuming. They're assuming that. Okay.
Because when he went before the Pharaoh...
When he went before the Pharaoh was one thing.
I cannot do the job.
When he went before the Pharaoh was one thing. When he went before God, and subsequently when he went and told Aaron what he heard, it's not necessarily the same thing. Okay? You're right about one circumstance, doesn't necessarily carry over to the other. Okay, let's keep going. Remember, the next case was a case of sukkah. How many walls does a sukkah have? And remember, it was basukot, basukot, basukot. Basukot, but three times the word basukot was written. Okay? And the issue there was that one time it's written with a vav, and two times it's written without a vav. The one time that it's written with the vav, if you are reading Yesh Eim La Masoret, first Eim La Masoret, if the first time it's Basukot with a vav, means two. Basukot, next time, doesn't have a vav, that's one. Okay, so now we're up to three. Next time is without a vav also, that's one. We're up to four. Okay, so that's four. The first time we needed it just to learn the mitzvah of sukkah. Alright? So then how many do we have left? We have three left. Okay? So then the sukkah is required at three walls. If basukot, 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 each one is equal to two. Okay? That's two, four, six. There we had six. But there too, the first mention was required. Okay? So there, knock off two, because one is equal to two in that case. Right? The first one was two, so then we're left with four. So there, when we saw the first time, looking at the difference between Eim LaMasoret and Eim LaMikra, we understood how there was a difference of a point of view, whether a sukkah has four sides or three sides that are required. Okay? And remember, the whatever it is, the last side, if it be the fourth or if it be the third, is only a partial side. And that was Halacha Moshe Sinai. That was the law to Moses on Mount Sinai. Okay, now, if we're saying at this point that everybody agrees, Yesh Eim LaMikra, right, then it should be 2, 4, 6, take off 2 is 4, so everybody should agree there are 4. How could there be some who say there are 3? Okay. All right. Now we have to figure out how there could be a point of view that three makes sense. Okay. Vir Rabbi Shimon the Rabbanan Bahai Pelige. Rabbi Shimon and the rabbis disagree in the following way. Rabbi Shimon Savar Sechacha Lo Bai Kra. Rabbi Shimon, who has the point of view, Rabbi Shimon was the one who said that Yesh Eim La Mikra. Okay, that would mean that each of those mentions is plural. 2, 4, 6. Rabbi Shimon Savar, Sechacha Lo Ba'ekra. He holds that the covering of a sukkah does not require a separate indication in the verse. Here, the Gemara says, well, you might say that the very notion that there should be a covering, that is to say that the sukkah is not only a building, but it's a covering per se, that requires the thing itself, that requires the word, the time, at least one time that appears, it's necessary. And we've got to, therefore, when we do our count, we were taking one count for the mitzvah of sukkah. Okay. Well, we'll need another one. We might need another one. Not only to tell us about a sukkah, but the fact that a sukkah is based on the roof. Okay, that's not the same thing as saying that you need a sukkah. But it's possible that we'll need another one of those terms for that purpose. Maybe. So Rabbi Shimon and the rabbis disagree about the following. Rabbi Shimon Savar Sechacha Lo Baikra. Rabbi Shimon holds that the covering of a sukkah does not require a separate indication in the verse. He says it just refers, everybody knows what a sukkah is. Therefore, all four mentions of the sukkah may be used to teach how many walls are needed. Okay? So, remember with Rabbi Shimon, we had started out with six. First one we took off for the general concept of sukkah, the mitzvah of sukkah. So we had four left. Then we've got to figure out now how we can get down to three for the other guys. Oh, I know how we can get down to three for the other guys. They both accept four as the beginning point. And then the other guys say, well, we also need one mention of sukkah. One of those numbers has got to be to tell us that the key thing in the sukkah is the roof. Okay? So all we have shown here now is that in fact even the people who say three, they can also accept Yesh Ein LaMikra. They can also have that point of view. So we have now shown in all of the cases that we studied that in fact it is possible to believe Yesh Ein LaMikra because everybody agrees Yesh Ein LaMikra. Because we saw that with Chalav and Chelev, that cooking a kid in its mother's milk, that was based on the assumption that everybody agreed that the oral way that you hear it is the way that you understand it. Okay? Is that convincing? It's only stress. Convincing. It's like, it's what?
Stress.
Why is it a stretch?
To say it's the frach.
To say it's a stretch. Because you should assume that the first time that you mention sukkah, of course it's talking about the sukkah, right? That's Rabbi Shimon's point of view. Because what is a sukkah but the schach? But then again, it's got to be more than the schach if we're going to learn about the walls. Okay, so then that's some reasoning to that.
They seem to have abandoned the, not logic, but the kind of argument used previously in Brighton, which would have said, okay, four mentions means the first time it mentions means
first time it mentions is the mitzvah.
Okay, so the first mention would say there's four mentions of Sukkot.
No, three mentions of Sukkot.
Pardon me?
There are three mentions of Sukkot.
Three mentions of Sukkot?
Basukkot, three. Okay, remember there were three. The first one is plural. The second one are pronounced plural, but they look singular. Okay, they don't have any vowels in the second two. Okay?
So where did the four come from?
Well, the Sukkot in Hebrew, if you said Sukkot.
Oh, Sukkot before the top.
Like that. Wait, Sukkot is a feminine plural. Because
right.
Sukkah is a feminine word. Exactly.
I thought the was above.
No. It's the Sukkot. It's the feminine plural.
But didn't they have a word for roof? I mean, why do we imply roof?
Oh, that's very basic to the laws of Sukkah, because the roof is crucial to the Sukkah. All the laws...
Roof when they meant roof?
How do you say roof?
I don't know.
Oh, well, now I'm telling you. The way you say it is you say schach. Schach. Is the roof of the sukkah is called schach.
So that's the confusion is listening for schach and sukkot?
Where do we get the word schach from? Sukkah. Okay?
Tautology.
Correct. But it's a tautology, and it's an etymology. I don't know if it's a tautology as much as an etymology. If schach and sukkah are essentially the same word, then the most crucial aspect of the sukkah is its roof. Okay, and that, in fact, is halacha. Halacha is that if your roof has a problem, that's where your major problem is. Well, that's not entirely true, because you have to have a certain limit, a minimal number of walls also in the sukkah. You can't just have a roof.
You cannot have a roof.
No, you could. I could think of how to do it. Yeah. You could have four pipes. Four pipes.
A chuppah.
Exactly. A chuppah. No. Because a side has to be a minimum size. All right? It has to be at least a tefillin on the side. Well, but it has to be more than a side. That last side can be a minimal side. But the other sides have to be six tefachim.
The question is, surprisingly, there is unanimity, which we have never had before.
Well, you're not going to keep it long.
Okay, so
you have it for a minute. But don't think you're going to have it for 2 minutes.
Right, about this one point about the oral taking precedence.
Right.
But does anybody say the vav was a mistake?
There's never a mistake
in the writing or the translation.
Well, you'll see. I say the answer is no. Nobody would ever. It's incomprehensible.
Because it was cut out like half of the Talmud.
Correct. That's right. There were those, and particularly in the modern period, who wanted to do that, but of course that undermines the whole system.
I mean, it seems as though all of this is to rationalize an inconsistency that cannot be acknowledged, that maybe one place was an error that it should have been.
I wouldn't say like that. It doesn't rationalize an inconsistency. Since there is no possibility of inconsistency, it explains to us the meaning behind what we have in front of us.
Okay.
Okay.
If they were to use the same argument used in the Vrata about how many times sprinkling of the blood is necessary based on the text, they would have to say, if it says Sukkot four times, that means four walls are okay. Three times means three are okay, two means two are good enough, one means one is good.
Okay.
Here they become very logical. Well, trying to
the difference is that the laws of Korbanot are unique. What we have said about the reasoning in the laws of Korbanot and the fact that you have to have repetition in order to have certainty of the numbers, that only applies to sacrificial law. And it applies to no other area of the law. It's a peculiarity of the sacrificial laws. Okay? So even though you might want to do that, in their system it doesn't work. Right? Because that only applies to the sacrificial laws. Okay? All right. Now, I hope that you're convinced that this is perfectly logical, because the Gemara will now tell you it's all wrong. Okay? Now the Gemara says, "Udekuli alma yesh em lemikra." You mean to say that everybody agrees that primacy is always given to the way something is read, and it's going to now show us a case where that's not true? And all it needs is one case to show us that it's not true, and it's not true. Okay, look at the case of Prince. So after. Yeah, after we go back one side, the other side, and then we're convinced that we know where we are, and we all agree that it must be that the way it's read has primacy. The Gemara again now says it's not true. Look at the following case, Tratanya. There is a writer that says the following: Letotafot. Letotafot. Okay, letotafot. Three times. When the law of tefillin is described, the word totafot appears. Totafot. Ukshatam ma'ot ayadecha, you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand. Vayu letotafot beinecha. And they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. Okay? Now, the tefillin themselves are actually made in a way that is responsive to this language. Because there are four portions in the Torah where tefillin is mentioned. Two of them we read last week. If you were in the synagogue last Shabbat, you heard me say that our bar mitzvah boy, when I was teaching him tefillin, he said, that's in my parsha. He says, I know that. That's what I'm reading on Saturday. I said, you got it. You are absolutely right. That's what you are reading. Interestingly enough, in the portion that we read this parsha about in Parshat Bo, the end of the parsha has two paragraphs where tefillin are mentioned. The first time they're mentioned, it says, Ukshatam laot ayadecha, not exactly like sure, the al yadcha, I think it says, you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, v'hayu lezikaron ben enecha, and they shall be for a remembrance between your eyes. Okay, very interesting. The other three places there that it's mentioned doesn't say zikaron, a remembrance, but it says letotafot, for frontlets between your eyes. Okay? So the first time says remembrance, which is important in learning about what the meaning of tefillin is. because it is to teach us, to remind us of something. Okay? And then you have pieces of scripture. In the Tefillin are the four places where the Tefillin are mentioned, those four paragraphs. Two of them are in the Shema. First paragraph of the Shema, Bi'ahavta, starts Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokim Hashem Echad. Di'ahavta. And then it gets to Kshatam La'ota Yadecha, Yishabah Nefrasan upon your hands, and there shall be fulfillments between your eyes. The second paragraph of the Shema, V'ayayim Shamo Tishma Uel Mitzvotai. You must listen to my commandments. Okay? If you listen to them, following will happen. Then it gets to the end and it says, Ukshatam la'ot al yadecha v'ayu l'tatafot ben enecha. You shall bind them for a sign upon your hands and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. Okay. There's a four places. How are they actually put in the tefillin? In the tefillah shel yad, the one that goes on the arm, and there is a box, and there is a long piece of parchment, and it is written paragraph after paragraph. According to the understanding of Rashi, it is in the order in which they are in the Torah, and then it's rolled. That long piece of parchment is rolled, or in one that I have upstairs that I use to sometimes illustrate this. It's done, and it's done in such a way, I should show you that as a matter of fact. Take a break. 2 minutes. I'll be right back. I want to show you first. Okay, forgive me, I should have thought to bring this down. I didn't. This is a Tefillah Shel Yad. It's a small one, an old one. It was one that was all falling apart by the time it got to me, and so I opened it up in order to use it as an example. I open it up inside, and I'll send it around too. As you can see, it's got a central compartment to it. Okay? Central compartment. And in that central compartment it's a long piece of parchment. Actually, you'll see that it's a few pieces of parchment that are two pieces that are put together, turned together, and those are the four paragraphs. Okay? All on one piece of parchment. Okay. Just take this, send it around. And take a look at it. Now, the Shel Rosh, the tefillah on the head. It's a little hard to see from where you are. Maybe you can see that. You see?
Yeah.
Okay. What it is, is four separate compartments. When you look at tefillin, generally when I when I show somebody tefillin and they look at that, they say, I say, what's going on the outside? And people will say, well, there are marks, scratch marks, that go around on the tefillin. In fact, they're not scratch marks. They are separate compartments. Every compartment of the shel rosh is separate. Every compartment is separate. And in each compartment that is separate, you have one of those paragraphs. You have one of those paragraphs. I'll send this one around. Okay. Folded. You'll see, though, you'll be able to take a look at it. It's folded, and then it's tied with a piece of cotton. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, yes?
It says with the totafot, totafot, totafot. Ktiv chaser twice, and ktiv male in the last time.
Correct.
So, ktiv chaser, I can call it letotefet, letotefet, letotafot. Why don't you use the singular? It's the same writing.
Well, that's true in all of these. It's true in all of these things. Where
no,
we have
letotefet, letotefet.
Yes.
And the first one is to make the case. The second one is the real one, and the last one is.
Well, we don't know that it's necessary to make the case. No, because there, remember, because we had another, the whole concept. We had another source, which was the first one, which was Lezikaron. Okay, that could be, have made the case. Right, to just tell us about the mitzvah of the tefillin itself, of the head tefillah. So then we're free to interpret these other three uses, which are letotafot, and one appears to be in the plural, and two appear to be in the singular. So, here's the way the Gemara then goes. Dehatanya, we have a baraita that says, letotafot, letotafot, letotafot. Right, the first time it's spelled letotafot, the second time, letotafot are could be read as singular, so that's two. One and one is two, right? And then the last one is plural. That's two. So two plus two is four. Therefore, we learn about the shel rosh, that it has four compartments in it. We learn four compartments in the shel rosh. That's how we learn. Or it could be. And I think that it's important to keep this in mind. I don't want to argue this too strongly because, in fact, in the Gemara, when this argument is made, the argument is, it is assumed that the shape of the tefillin is Halacha Moshe Misinai. God explained to Moses on Mount Sinai how the tefillin was supposed to be constructed. Therefore, this may be an after-the-thought argument to try and base something we already know on a scriptural verse. Okay? That's very logical here. Okay? But let's just take the Gemara for what it's saying now. The Gemara is saying that there is this argument, and obviously it is taking something, and arekan arba. There are, by virtue of using the Em L'Masoret technique, namely, reading it the way that it should be read, that it could be read, we learn four from that. Divrei Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Akiva Omer. Rabbi Akiva learns the four compartments from something else. Eino tzarich. We don't need this interpretation, Rabbi Akiva says. And rather, look at his interpretation. Tot bekapvei shtayim. Tot, in the language of the Katfei region, wherever it is that they speak Katfei, that's a language that he apparently was familiar with. It is some language. The word tot means two. I thought be'afrike shtayim. Afrike, you could pick up, it's an African language. Right? In other words, in North Africa, there was tradition that in their language, Fot is Stein, is two. So he says two and two. This is just analogies to two other languages. Now, of course, this is not what you would call a compelling argument, which is why I stated first that the concept doesn't come from this. The concept comes from Halacha Moshe Mitzrayim. Rather, what the rabbis are trying to do now is to ground a concept that is already known in the words of Scripture. But as the commentary says, at any rate, it is clear that Rabbi Yishmael gives primacy to the written form, unlike Rabbi Acha Bar Yaakov's contention that all Tanaim assign primacy to the pronounced form. Right? Rabbi Acha Bar Yaakov has been arguing that Yesh Eim LaMikra is accepted by everybody. Okay? So here we see a good baraita which says it's not true. It's not true. Ela Leolam Paligi. David Maragos on it says, rather, the Tanaim indeed disagree about Yesh Eim LaMikra Ve'Eim LaMasoret. The Hani Mili Ki Paligi, but when do they disagree? Hechad Deshane Kra MiMasoret. Where the pronounced form differs from the received written form. Aval hai chalev v'chelev d'chiyadadininu. But in regard to milk and fat, which are identical in the way they're written, yesh em la mikra, everybody agrees that primacy is given to the pronounced form. So, in other words, finally, the Gemara says, you're right. There are areas where people do disagree about that, and that's always and limited to those cases where things are written differently. Where they're written differently, where there's either a vav or no vav, there is a difference of opinion. But where the letters are the same, and there is no difference of opinion, there's never a difference of opinion about that. Okay. So, of course, that's very compelling until the Gemara brings you an example where it's not true. Okay. So, extremely what Gemara says, that's very nice, but it's not true. Okay. So, here is the final case that Gemara is going to bring. V'hare yir'eh yera'eh. Here's a case where we're going to have a baraita, where you have a word yir'eh and yera'eh. Yir'eh and yera'eh look exactly the same. The letters are precisely the same. What we just learned is where you have the letters precisely the same, you go according, there's one way to read it, and you go according to Eim LaMikra, whatever the tradition of how to read it is. Okay? So here it says, yira'eh and yera'eh. That is in the commandment that all of your males shall appear three times a year in the temple. Right? Those are the three pilgrimage festivals. And where is it? It's quoted down here. Here, look at verse number 29. Shalosh pa'amim ha'shana, three times a year, yera'eh kol zechorcha, all of your males shall appear. Yera'eh, shall appear. Et penei Adon Hashem, with the face of the Lord your God, the God of Israel. Okay, three times a year they have to appear. Yera'eh. And listen to the Baraita then. Tehi hadan deininu polige, they are exactly spelled the same. And Ditanya. And here's a baraita. Yochanan ben Dahavai Omer Mishum Rabbi Yehuda ben Tema. Yochanan ben Dahavai says in the name of Rabbi Yehuda ben Tema. Hasumeh b'echat einav patur min ha'ri'iya. A person who is blind in one eye doesn't have the mitzvah of aliyah l'regel. Right? If you're blind in one eye, you don't have the mitzvah of going to Jerusalem three times a year. Listen to the reasoning here. Because it says, Yera'eh, Yir'eh. The word Yera'eh can be read also as Yireh. Yireh means to appear. He will appear. Yireh means he will see. He will see. Alright? Now listen. Kederach shabal lir'ot, kach bal lera'ot. In the manner that he, namely God, sees. This is the interpretation. The manner that God sees. The manner that God sees, kach bal lera'ot, so a person comes to be seen. And it'll explain it. Ma lir'ot b'shtei einav, as God sees with two eyes, that is to say, God is not blind. God has perfect vision. As God sees with perfect vision, because you can read Yireh as Yireh, when you read it as Yireh, it applies to God. When you read it as Yireh, it applies to the person who appears. It could be read either way. It could be read either way. Just as God sees with two eyes, namely has perfect vision, af le'ra'ot b'shtei einav, similarly the person who appears has to have perfect vision, namely has two eyes. Alright? Now, whether you agree with this or you disagree with this, the point is that we have a baraita here. We have a baraita where there is one word. There are not two possible readings in terms of the letters that appear in the Torah. There is one set of letters, and you see that the Baraita has two different ways to read that one set of letters. We just said that when you have one set of letters, everybody agrees that there's only one way to read it. And now we have a Baraita that says that you have one set of letters and two ways to read it.
I can give you another one.
Don't bother. All I need is one. Okay? So now we're back where we started from. Right? Once again, we don't know whether Eim LaMasoret VeEim LaMikra. Ella. Gemara is finally going to conclude. Ella Amar Rav Acha B'Rei D'Rav Ika. In fact, Amar kra lo tevashel gedi derech bishul asna Torah. The Torah prohibits a mixture in the manner of cooking. When you said there is always, it always has to be read the same way, chalev imo, the truth is, the Gemara family says, it doesn't have to be read that way. You could have read it another way. And why do we have to read it the way in which we do read it? Because it says, "Lo tevashel gedi bechalev imo," you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. If it had been talking about fat, would you boil? It would have said that you have to fry it. Exactly.
So there is a biblical word for fry.
Yeah, there is. There's a biblical word for fry. So if it had, it was the very fact that it says boil. All right, makes it clear then that the reading is chalev and not chalev. So, in other words, the Gemara sustains this point of view, which says that there are, in certain cases, two possible readings of things, even where it is one word, and there aren't two different ways to read it in terms of the letters that are there, but even the one word. So it's true for chalev is not. We could have read it chalev. But it's other evidence in the verse that tells us how to read it. So ultimately, this is the end of the argument. And ultimately we see that the rabbis throughout this argument are arguing both sides. The final conclusion is that sometimes there could be yesh im lamasoret. It is possible for there to be something learned from the written form. Okay, but generally speaking, my reading of this has been that the stronger argument has always come out yesh eim lamikra. Right? That's the stronger argument, I think. But I don't know really. I can't really say that because the very last thing that is said, in a way, supports the former argument yesh eim lamasoret. Very often in interpretation, the last thing that said has force simply because it's the last thing that said. Okay? But both these points of view, therefore, are points of view that are ultimately of significance. Okay? Now, to get back just a few words to relate this back to where we were last week and what we had said about that, one other thing I want to show you regarding this film. It seems to me that the issue that we raised is really a philosophical issue. We saw it last time in terms of the Midrash Tanhuma, where the Tanhuma said the following, the HaTorah Bameh Hayta Ketuvah. How was the Torah written? Al Gabe Eish Levana Ve'Eish Shechora. It was black fire on white fire. And we start from there and we saw the way in which Ramban also used that notion for his interpretation of the Torah, his idea that if you were to have all the letters of the Torah, you wouldn't necessarily know where to separate them. And he gave the example of Bereshit Bara. And he separated the letters differently, and he came out with a completely different... What?
Barosh.
Tivra. Barosh Yitbara. In the beginning, he was created, which of course is completely contrary to the Torah. You can never say God was created. So his point was that we are ultimately always dependent, thank you, on the oral law in order to be able to know how to write the Torah. And ultimately, the way it is written is crucial. There is always a relation, then, between the white space and the black letters. Because if the white space appeared differently, according to the Ramban, we would have different words. We would have different words. That is the black fire on the white fire. Okay? I think that is, just philosophically, theologically, a very, very basic idea here, that our whole ability to comprehend really is very subtle and depends on much, as much on what is not said as what is said. Okay? I wanted to show you finally another example of this, of the dark on the light. And it relates to the tefillin. Letter right here. I don't know how many of you took a close look at the Shalrosh, but I'll send it around if you want another time. And there is the letter Shin on the Shalrosh. Have you noticed the difference between these two Shins? Did you see that? Send it back around so people can see it. One Shin has four legs on it. The other Shin has three. Okay, look at that. Okay, who knew? You were putting on filling and you never looked. You never saw. Okay? One Shin has four legs and one Shin has three legs.
The four is unusual, right? Three more years.
But did you have a sibling like that before? The Gemara says, when it discusses the Shin of Tefillin, it says, Shin shel Tefillin alachala Moshe Mishinai. The Shin of the Tefillin is the law to Moses on Mount Sinai. And what that means is that our custom of having a Shin with three legs and a Shin with four legs is the law to Moses on Mount Sinai. So that goes back to the very beginning. We understand it, however. The commentators understand it to actually have a meaning. And I want to show you what the meaning is.
All tefillin
are made the same way. All tefillin shalrosh. The shalyad has nothing written on it. It's simply a box. The shalrosh is created in this way with the two different shins. The three and the four. All have that. Okay? just wanted to show you how to understand this. This is a shin. I made a large shin so you could see it. Okay? And I made the large shin in black.
Oh, so the white.
This is black. This is the black fire that is on the white fire. But if you look at the white space, right, how many legs are there? There are one, two, but then there's three, and there's four. Okay? So in fact, I go further.
What is the negative and what is the positive?
When the Torah was given on Mount Sinai, you have to remember that God wrote in the tablets, the Torah says, writing went from side to side. So in fact, the way it looked originally was like this, but you have a mental game here that on the one hand, it's four, if you look at the white space. If you look at the black space, it's three. That's why you have on the tefillin three and four. No, to remember. To remember that all of this is a revelation, to remind you that this is the revelation to Moses from God on Mount Sinai. Okay? This is not just writing. But at the same time, I think that what you see here, having read this portion that we've been reading about Eim LaMikra VeEim LaMasoret, is that ultimately everything is dependent upon the letters and then on the white space. The white space, in a way, determines the meaning of everything that is written. So everything that is not said is as important as everything that is said in order to know what is said. Maybe. Yeah, it could be. But here, let me do it then this way. I'll do it this way. It's the same thing. You turn it upside down. What?
If you take four and you turn it upside down, then you have a shin in the negative space.
If you have, if you have the four,
yeah, you turn that upside down.
You have a shin in the negative space. That's correct.
On one side, you have a shin in the positive.
Correct.
On the other side,
you have a shin in the negative. That's great.
Ooh.
That's great. That's great.
So and you do have two sides. But
correct.
It reminds me a little bit that the composer, and I'm not meaning to compare this in any way, but the composer John Cage was interviewed about his unusual methods of music in which he can have these long empty spaces. And somebody asked him which was more important, the notes or the rests. And he said, he had an answer. He said, the notes don't mean anything without the rests. So, I mean, it's also a musical thing, too.
Correct.
It's not just
correct.
Visual of black and white, sound and no sound.
I think it is true. In all, and to go back to the Derrida that we were reading about last night, though I know at last time, though I know some of you are not very happy with Derrida, even so, what Derrida is saying is that all reality is text. All reality is text. That is to say that all comprehension that we have of anything really deals with the uncertainties and the certainties. But every certainty is filled with the uncertainty because of the nature of the black and the white. Of the, as you said, the rests and the music. But you cannot have one without the other, and that is therefore the basic nature of reality. It's the basic nature of music, it's the basic nature of the mind, it's the basic nature of learning, and it's also the basic nature of the revelation from God. Okay, exactly.
And in art, it's a you know basic principle of the field and the subject.
Exactly.
And I mean, when I'm thinking now, this comes from you know Torah. That's where this all started.
Well, I don't know that others couldn't come up with this idea, but it's obvious that. And we're reading things that are 2,000 years old here, and this was already a highly developed idea by then, in the Talmud, for sure. And that's the way we understand the Torah. Very basic understanding the Torah. No?
Is there also an argument that light is really not uncertainty, but is what gives an order to the black and meaning to the
Definitely. Black? Definitely. Yep. 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 What happens, though, when I said uncertainty, in a way, it creates certainty because it gives meaning to the black, right? It's the border, correct. And without the border, you have no, there is no shape. There is no shape there. You don't know what weight to give to it, though. Sometimes you just don't know what weight to give to the border. You know, how significant is the border? How significant, that was the question that you asked, how significant are the rests? How significant are the rests? Okay?
When they found the Qumran scroll, the Dead Sea scroll, I think it was the book of Yechezkel, that there are two characters that are the old, what they found, and compared to today's, what we have as our Yechezkel, the book of Yechezkel, two characters are different in two places. And how do they square it? If this is all correct, the way that it was once,
well,
and it's the same
sequence. There are two things. First of all, the purity of the text only is for the Torah. We're only saying this only goes for the Torah. However, having said that, the principles that we are dealing with now, I think, can go for any text. And I think that we're really dealing now with any text that exists, or any art that exists, or any music that exists. We're dealing now with some basic interpretive realities that are just more basic than anything in the world.
So, is there any methodology for discussing the white spaces? I mean, I don't mean this facetiously, but I mean, the philosophers say, okay, let's have a class on the white spaces. They,
sure.
They do.
Oh, yeah. You better believe it. Yep. In postmodern philosophy, that's a major discussion. Correct.
Yes. It's probably as easy to understand as the read article.
There you go.
It seems to be notable for the Torah that lacks any grammatical
That's true.
Preparation, Correct. Lacks any delineation of where white and black should be understood and comprehended.
Correct.
Well, black's diet, what is called diet,
that's critical.
Critical, right. And so I'm still extraordinarily troubled by this, your argument, given the text. And that's why I made the comment about we really don't have four white, because you have to go on to the next. Nothing can stand alone. No syllable, no, what do you call that stuff, vowel, no consonant. It can't stand alone. It has to be seen in the continuum.
Yeah,
and the continuum
that's a perfectly,
doesn't have.
It's a perfectly good argument.
So
but frankly, I can also imagine taking the white space
right.
and seeing the white space with what comes to the right of it
yes.
and with what comes to the left of it.
It was your analogy to rests that got me going.
Oh, okay.
There are no rests in the Torah. There's no punctuation, there's no rests, there's no pause. None.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what got me mm-hmm. trying to still understand the argument. And I know we want to make analogies for us to understand.
Yeah, well, I was dealing specifically here with the shin.
Right.
The shin, I think, can go both ways.
Right.
I'm just commenting on that. The Torah is interesting because it's true. Well, there are traditions of how we write a Sefer Torah, that we write, you have to begin a column with a vav, or you normally begin it with a vav. You have to begin it with some letter of the divine name. In truth, I should say, you know, if we're going to talk about the Torah, we do have traditions of breaks in the Torah. So it's not entirely true that it's just straight letters. I mean, we have two types of tradition here. Number one, we have tradition of words. We do have tradition. As Nachmanides said, it's Bereshit Bara,
yes.
not Berosh Yitbara. So we do have, in fact, traditions of white space. Go even further with that, we have traditions of white space that separate sections. We do have even sentences that are occasionally separated, and they're sectional separations. And they're of two kinds. There's the skura, which is in the middle of a line where you end a verse here, and then you have white space, and then you begin in that same line something else. That's one type of separation. Then you have another type of separation, which is where you have to begin, sepetucha, you begin on the next line. You always have to begin there. So, while it's true, I mean, it should be recognized that there are, in the Torah itself, certain traditional separations of white space. Okay? Okay.
One is about visual perception. I mean, probably most of you have seen the goblet versus the two faces, the two profiles, and that's a classic example of either seeing the white space or seeing the black. And there, the most interesting thing is you can't perceive both simultaneously.
There are some people who can.
Well. Synesthesia, a little different issue, but now some people have made the argument that this is conditioned to some extent on your environment. So the arguments have been made that if you live in a jungle where things are going to jump out at you that you need to protect yourself against, you're going to be tending to see the dark. Whereas if you live on the sea and you have to keep scanning the horizon, the white is the way you learn to perceive the world. The thing that strikes me is given the intrinsic ambiguity, because that's really the key issue here, is the written is ambiguous, that there were so many different choices that they could have made. So, for example, they could have used the ambiguity to say you can learn two things from one word, not one. And yet they chose to say that you can only learn one thing from one section. The idea of excluding the first mention as being able to learn something is a very strong choice, given that I would think that you would always want to be maximizing information flow. So those I find interesting, but the thing that's so powerful, though, in the face of the authority of the work, is the weight that's given to what the community understands.
Exactly.
And so it's really three things that are authoritative. It's the written, it's the oral, and it's
the community.
The culture.
I couldn't have summarized Jewish life better than you just did. It's an excellent summary. It's an excellent summary because that's the reality. Those are the three steps that are necessary. And therefore, the community that does the interpreting is a basic piece of the interpretation itself.
Let's say in a less philosophical approach, the Torah itself the physical Torah has meaning. We stand up when your own is open, we are very careful in its presence without ever looking into it. What effect of having a text with no punctuation, no nekudot, no separation of sentences and paragraphs is, in a way, like the shorthand of the Gemara, makes it impossible for a person to learn it on his own the first time. You actually have to have a teacher. It's a way of ensuring a bond between parent and child, teacher and child, and also this is this is actually how it's transmitted. The child knows because his father and it's from my point of view, as a very good social tool to keep learning process.
Shakach, to be continued. Another one? To be continued.